While exploring the second floor, you come across an old wooden door. Carved into the gnarled frame, you find the words...
Welcome to Doors and Dungeons, the retro gaming podcast, and this week we're going to talk about the fabled machine of legend that I've been putting off for so long. Yes, it's the NEC PC-8801. And to talk about it, we have here a friend and a companion, I guess you could say, throughout my several years now of messing with these machines. Someone who may not be all that famous to you, but is very, very, very helpful and knowledgeable to me, especially through Discord. This is Tech Fury.
Thanks for having me on, Michelle.
You're welcome. Okay, so let's get into this here. We're going to talk about the PC-88. Now, you should have learned a little bit about the PC-88 if you're a listener to this podcast, because I've probably mentioned it a few times. Especially earlier on in the PC-98 episodes, which it's kind of funny that I would do PC-98 before I would do PC-88, but history can go in any order. Who cares? So, the PC-88 is the predecessor, sort of, to the PC-98. I'm guessing the PC-88, at least the earlier models, did come out before the 98 series launched. Is it? Do you remember if that's correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I believe it came out about a year before the PC-98.
Yeah. And basically, as is common with most of NEC's stuff, it's all sort of derivative of their earlier stuff. They kind of sort of like went in a progression, like a line of progression, almost kind of the way IBM, I guess, did, but very much Japanese. And so the 98 sort of kind of builds on the 88, but not. And then the 88 builds on something earlier called the 8000. So we have NEC, and they released a bunch of computers, and then, I don't know, a few computers. And then they really started to get like on their feet with the 6000. Is it 6000 or 6001?
Well, the funny thing is, I think the 6001s actually came later. I think that was kind of intended as more of a... lower end, more entry level product.
Okay. Well, then the 8000 one is the I was going to say next, but the or the 8000.
The 8000 is actually the very first. Well, 8001. I think like one of them's the export model and one isn't. I don't remember. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, let's see here. Wikipedia can answer this because, you know, I definitely researched this ahead of time. Yeah, sometimes it's called 8000. Or sometimes 8001. And it was sold in the U.S., apparently.
So was the 8801, actually.
Yeah, you know, I've read that somewhere, and I have not found very much information about it. I've never been able to, like, find like even images of the model. Well, no, I think I did see one picture of one of those models once.
But yeah, it's not they exist, but they're very, very rare.
Yeah. So the 8001, we're going to mention briefly here. When did the 6001 come out? I have to look that up because I know they're definitely not as advanced, but if they came out afterwards, then yeah, probably that sort of that low end sort of Commodore.
Yeah, but
approach,
they had the best commercials for them though.
I haven't seen any of those.
They had some. I think it was the 6601, which is kind of related to it, and it was also marketed as Mr. PC, and they had a commercial for it. It's on YouTube somewhere. And it's just this weird, like, acid trip influenced, very peak 1980s Japanese commercial. Personal computer plus television. Mr. PC. PC. Keyboard. Wireless keyboard. Japanese word processor. Okay. Color. 15-inch graphic. Superimposed. PC. 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 PC.
Okay, so we have the 8000 series, and the 8000 series is a very, very standard sort of Z80 kind of system, running basic. It's an NEC basic. It's actually called N88 basic. Is that right? Or N?
Actually called just N basic.
N basic. Okay, yeah. And then later on, they come up with the 88.
Yeah, and I think the PC 8001 was also the first domestically produced home computer in Japan to hit, I think, 100,000 units sold.
The 8000?
It originally came out in 1979, I believe.
Yes, that's correct. Which is now 40 years ago. Wow.
Yeah, it's also 2 years before the IBM PC.
True, and apparently it could run disk basic and CPM, which
it was marketed mainly as a CPM machine when they exported them to the US. Hmm. If you find, there's a few old reviews of them from magazines that you can probably find scans of on the internet. I've looked before, and they usually reviewed it as a CPM machine.
Interesting. And it looks very much like a lot of the computers at the time that were basically all in one little kits, where they're kind of like, what do you call them? What do you call those things? Like the little keyboard in one deals? Is there a word for those things?
Well, NEC actually had one. It was called the TK-80, I think.
Yeah, but I'm saying like the 8000 series is that style of computer where it's the computer and keyboard in.
Oh, right. Yeah, I was just noting that NEC also made a single board kind of evaluation kit like that. Oh, right. Yeah, I was just noting that NEC also made a single board kind of evaluation kit like that. And there's actually an interesting thing about that. That board, the TK-80, actually prompted them to open a showroom in Akihabara called the Bid Inn. To like kind of promote it and kind of see what people would do with it. From what I can tell, it was kind of run as kind of sort of an early sort of hackerspace kind of thing, but details are unfortunately really scant. But that later kind of then turned into their flagship personal computer showrooms, if you will.
I see. So I have this book that's called the Hobby Persicon Guide, right, or something like that. It's a Japanese book, but it's a fantastic. One of those is called them MOOCs, where they're like, so basically indie books.
Ooh, yeah, I've heard of these.
And they're really, really popular in Japan. It's a great way to skirt around copyright issues because they tend to get ignored by companies for some reason. And so there's one of them that is just this like awesome guide to all of the personal computers in Japan from the very earliest like breadboards with a LCD like four-number display up to like the late 98 series. And it's got, you know, all your major companies. There's all like random Bandai machines. Like there's a Gundam-based Bandai machine that they made.
Oh, yeah. The like RX-77 or something like that.
Yeah. And this book has like pictures of all of them and information about them. And it's really great.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. So the 6001 came out in 1981. And the 8000 series, or I mean the 88 series, came out in, what year did that come out? That's interesting.
December 81. Yeah.
Okay, so about the same time.
Yeah. So the 6001 is a little bit older by 1 month, huh? I never knew that.
But roughly the same time, and definitely different hardware, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. The specifications are way lower on the 6001, and so is the price.
Yeah, so that's another thing. The PC-88 series. Okay, let's get into the core here of the PC-88 series. So the PC-88 series starts out, and immediately you can tell one thing that's very different about it is that it is not one of those little box with a keyboards. It is a full desktop computer with a detachable keyboard, and it's much beefier looking than any other computer really on the market at the time, other than maybe something that Sharp was doing or something.
I don't think Sharp really had a lot by that point. Probably just the MZ series. X1 wasn't until 83.
Well, maybe I'm thinking of Fujitsu then, actually, the early FM stuff.
Early FM7's really a lot. The thing that kind of amuses me about the FM7 is in a lot of ways, it's really almost seems as if Fujitsu tried to match the specs of the PC-88 with it.
Yeah, it seems like it. Although, it's the actual like ways to read the data don't seem quite as good. Like the, because I believe they started out with tape. Is that right?
Well, so did the PC-88.
Well, yeah, but oh, that's true. I guess the first model. So let's get into that. Okay, so the very first model of the PC-88 is not a computer that any of you want to own. If you're gamers and you're interested in these computers for gaming, don't bother with the first model, and really don't even bother with the Mark II, but we'll get into that. The first model comes out, and it is a very desktop-y looking machine, and it's actually, despite me saying that you don't really want to own one, they look cool. The original model, I think, actually looks really neat, and how to describe it, it looks kind of IBM-ish, honestly.
It does, in a way. It does kind of have that brutalist IBM styling, and I have to admit, I kind of like that.
I do, too. Yeah, there's like a little, it's just like little plastic, brown plastic area to the right, which has the port to input your keyboard. And I guess the tape would have been in the back. I'm not really sure how that works on that, because I've never used one of
those.
Most
likely. I know, I think actually, did you know the original PC-9801 also had a cassette interface, I'm pretty sure?
The very first one? I don't.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that one did. If it didn't, I know there's actually a CBUS tape, cassette tape interface card,
but well, that would surprise me. There's CBUS everything.
There really is.
But yeah, so the 88 comes out, the very first 8801, and that does have the tape interface, but it also has the ability to use 8-inch floppy drives. And I believe you could later also get other floppy drives as well, like a 5-inch, 5 1/4-inch floppy drives. But I believe it first came with 8-inch as an option.
I think you're right.
And so it was kind of expandable in a way that not a lot of other computers were. And the keyboards on them are really interesting. They're very flat looking, and they've got this like brownish, like raised area around where all the keys are, up from like the base of the keyboard. Like, normally you have a keyboard, and it's, so if you look at your keyboard right now, if you're near a computer, you're normally, your keyboard is one solid piece of like either metal or plastic with the whole spaces for the keys, right?
Right.
And it's usually solid. It's usually like one thing. On this, you've got the shell going around it that looks like that. It's kind of white. But then you've got a raised up piece of plastic, almost like an extra layer, that goes around where the keys are, that's like a brownish, yellowish, or I mean brownish, orangish color, depending on how badly faded it is. But
you can never tell if it's factory original or if it's faded like that, you know?
This was the late 70s when things were just ugly to begin with. No, really, it started that way. Oh, yeah. And I've noticed that with NEC in particular, sometimes it's really hard to tell when something is really badly sun damaged and when it just came that way.
Right. I have that same problem with my PC-98's keyboard. I can't tell if the keys are just supposed to be kind of brown or if they've actually been faded, because the beige plastic doesn't really seem yellowed to me.
I think some of the earliest ones were. But anyway, so that's the first model. And there were a few games that were made on it, but this computer basically is basic. And I don't mean that in the sense of its capabilities. I mean, it literally just runs basic. There's an NEC version of basic that's put onto it, and it runs that. And you could make some moderately okay stuff on it. And it gained a little bit of traction. I don't think it sold super, super well. It sold all right, definitely. But then later on, I don't know when exactly. Let's see here. Let's see if Wikipedia will tell me. 1983. So about 2 years later, they come out with the Mark II. And the Mark II is where things really change. Although it's not quite there yet for this, the PC-88. The Mark II adds several things. First of all, it adds the option. Still not standard yet, but it adds the option for floppy drives built in.
5 1/4-inch, I believe.
Yes. Believe it or not, at least according to Wikipedia, which may or may not be right, as we'll explain a little bit, there were three different models of the Mark II, one of which had no floppy drive, one had one of them, and one had two. I find that slightly odd to think that there would be a model without a floppy drive in it for these, since the casing was designed for them. But since I've never seen one, I don't really know if that's real or not. But anyway, according to Wikipedia, if it is to be believed, there was a non-floppy drive version of the Mark II, which, okay.
Can you just imagine using that with cassettes?
No. I mean, cassettes have their own charm, but the software on these is way too intense for that.
Well, and also, have you ever actually used a cassette on an old home computer? It's not what I would exactly call an enjoyable experience. I mean, no, I can see why people were excited to get floppies.
Yeah, I mean, I have used it with MSX, and it's charming, but it's not fun. Yeah.
Agreed.
It's nostalgic, but not good nostalgic. It's, golly, I'm glad I don't have to keep doing this every time nostalgic.
We used it a lot on FM7, too. I think a lot of early FM7 games were on cassette.
Well, I think they were slower to adopt floppy drives, which is why I feel like it's a bit inferior in that sense, because I think even like some of the earliest versions of the EES games were on floppy drives, I think. I mean, not floppy drive, tape for FM7. Like, I think EES 1 had a tape version. I could look it up, but I'm pretty sure EES 1 had a tape version.
That sounds amazingly horrifying.
Yeah, I can't imagine. So the Mark II adds two very important things. One, it adds an actual sound chip, which is a Yamaha, and it's not the same one that's used in later models, but it is a Yamaha. And then it also adds what's called V1 mode. And V1 mode is where you start seeing like NEC going, okay, we're going to make this thing do more. And basically it adds in new graphics capabilities the original didn't have. And so you get V1 mode, which is 640 by 200 with 8 colors, or you could do 640 by 400 with 2 colors. And sometimes they'd switch back and forth and do little tricks and stuff with that to try and get more out of it. But it really upgraded what the machine could do, but it still wasn't quite there yet. It wasn't really until 1985 that you really start to get the core of what PC-88 is to most users. And that's the Mark II SR. And the Mark II SR is still not the best version you can get, but it's still one of the most compatible versions you can get in a lot of ways. Mainly because it has the most sort of rounded out set of features. It's got the FM synthesis with the YM2203. It's got your in mode, which is your compatibility for the old software. So the 8801, the Mark II, and then the Mark II SR and on, any of those that have in mode means that they can run software from the 8000 series, which is all basic software. And it actually turns the FM chip into a little beeper, like a PC beeper speaker. And it sounds really hilariously bad, but it's, you can do it.
Oh, does it really? I've never actually heard one of them in the flesh, but I'm somehow not surprised.
Yeah, I've loaded up a few games in mode when I was doing an earlier podcast about the earliest of like Western RPG style Japanese games, mainly like the Black Onyx, and also this game called Dungeon that was made by Koei. And it was just...
I think I've heard of that.
It's not good at all. It's like Ultima. It's basically a straight ripoff of Ultima 1, except they don't put you anywhere near a town when you start off. It's randomized. So you could be somewhere near a town, or you could be out in the middle of nowhere, and you really only have enough HP to last like two battles at the most. So if you don't start out near a town, you just can't progress the game at all. It's really bad. But it does have beeper sound, and it uses the FM chip. If you've got one of the later models, it uses the FM chip to make those beeper sounds. So it's really hilariously bad. But anyway, It starts out sort of, like I said, sort of IBM-ish, and then it kind of goes off in its own way. So they have this NEC chip that's sort of like a Z80. It's called the...
It's pretty much just a reverse engineered clone of the Z80, is really what it is. Well, it might not be reverse engineered. I can't remember. I know the NEC 8086 was, but I think the Z80 may have actually been licensed. But it's basically, for all intents and purposes, just a Z80.
Yeah, I think there's a few minor changes to it, but nothing like... Not like, say, for example, like the Nintendo. I mean, that's definitely a very modified version of it. I think this is fairly similar. But NEC did manufacture those chips themselves.
Correct.
They were not manufactured by Zilog or however you say that in that company.
It's really amazing how much NEC used their own chips
and
their own
definitely.
Computers. And it's also really not surprising because I think it was either 1984 or 1985 that NEC actually became the world's largest chip manufacturer, and they held that title until, I think, the mid to late 90s.
Hmm.
It's mainly because they had really good, really cheap RAM.
Yeah, and I think you start to see, you can see this kind of play out in the 98 series. You don't see it in the earlier series, but in the 98 series, you see them, you can track their decline. As they start going, oh crap, everything needs to be Intel now. And oh crap, everything needs to be Windows now. Oh crap, we need to start using IDE. We need to start using PS2. Well, they don't really quite got to that point. But they started like shifting things towards the Western style of computer as they realized that their like little dominance was not going to last.
Well, they actually had been experiencing a lot of competitive market pressure. I think Compaq was one of the first to really try to undercut the PC-98. And that was a big deal, actually.
Well, technically, Epson sort of tried that.
Well, Epson's actually a really interesting case. I don't know if this is really commonly known in the Western PC-98 world, but... interesting thing about this is NEC actually sued Epson for those clones.
Oh, yeah. I think we talked about that in one of my podcast episodes, actually.
Yeah, and I probably should have listened to it in all honesty.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't remember. We may have or we may not have, but it is an interesting story. So, yeah, please feel free to go ahead and throw that in there real fast, and then we'll get back to the 88 itself.
Yeah, basically, to save face, they ended up settling NEC's probably completely frivolous patent and copyright infringement lawsuit, and they paid a licensing fee.
Well, no, actually they didn't exactly.
Really?
No, what ended up happening was I think they settled to get out of the any sort of liability, but one of the stipulations of the settlement is that they had to remove the BIOS because the BIOS that they were using was essentially backwards, like reverse engineered from NEC's own BIOS. So that's why there's switches on the front of all of the later, like the 286 and on, all have switches instead of the actual, or not switches, but jumpers. I don't know, the jumpers or switches? I don't remember. But anyway, they've got switches or jumpers on the front that do all of the BIOS settings because the BIOS itself was copyrighted, and so they actually had to remove that part. So there's no on-screen BIOS like there is in all the other 98 models because
that's
of that lawsuit. And so if you look at the very earliest models of the Epson PCs, they actually use a BIOS that's ripped straight from NEC, and then they stop. And it makes them harder to use unless you get it to where, you know, you don't need to change any of the settings. Once you've got it, like, good. Because those are not hard drives or anything like that. So generally speaking, once you've got it where you want it, you just flop, you know, throw in your disks and you're good to go. But I actually gave one of those to my friend, and he's liking it now, mainly because he doesn't have to worry about any of that kind of stuff because I configured it for him. But yeah, so that's kind of how that lawsuit ended up, was that they were able to continue doing it because the hardware itself was not necessarily copyrighted, but the BIOS was the part that they really got in trouble with. So
that doesn't surprise me.
No, I don't think so.
I mean, if they clean room reverse engineered it correctly, technically that would be legal, but I feel like that's a case of Japanese copyright law may not agree with U.S. copyright law's precedent on that, if you get my drift.
Well, I think there was a little bit of a and now this could be complete speculation, and this is way off topic, but I think it could be a little bit of revenge, because I believe that I don't remember if it was NEC or who it was, but one of the other companies, there was like this little like conspiracy to go over to was it IBM, I think, and like steal some of their data and bring it back.
Are you talking about the famous IBM? What's the words I'm looking for? The famous case with Fujitsu and Hitachi and Mitsubishi.
I think that might have been what it was. I do not know how truthful that story is.
There's a lot of complicated stuff about that that seems kind of fishy. I do know NEC was actually not party to any of that, though.
Okay.
That had to relate with the claims made were essentially that so IBM's mainframe operating systems up till about the early 80s weren't copyrighted. They're public domain, source code available, all that stuff. So the Japanese mainframe companies, in this case Fujitsu, Hitachi, and Mitsubishi, basically took that IBM code and heavily modified it and kind of releases their own OS, which was fine for a while. But after a point, they kind of started stealing code from IBM.
Well, I heard, and this is, could be speculation, but I heard that there was actual people being sent over there to like actual steal documents from IBM. I do not know if that's true or not. Like actually go in there, get access to them, and make illegal copies of the of.
So
of
I looked
form.
At that, and apparently a lot of that initial claim, the actual substance of it, at least if I recall correctly reading this, and this was about 6 months ago, so I could be a little wrong. Apparently it had to do with IBM gave one of their software development partners kind of a pre-release specification manual.
That's right.
And they copied that manual in exchange for money and sent a copy to Fujitsu.
Yeah, that's
and
that
then after
right.
that. And then after that, IBM kind of set up a sting operation with somebody. They weren't actually stealing them from IBM headquarters. It was IBM's little sting operation.
I see. So now, do you know roughly what year that would have been? Would that have been before this?
Early 80s.
Okay.
So I want to say sometime around 81.
Okay.
I think the case was prosecuted stirring, I think, in 83 or 84. I'd have to look it up, but those numbers sound right to me.
So it's possible, just barely slightly possible, that NEC, when they were taking on Epson, were thinking, you know what? We're going to get back for that. You know, even if they
weren't
involved
in it.
Well, the interesting
thing is NEC was never party to any of that, because NEC's own little mainframes.
Yeah, but it's still, you know, it's still very Japan versus the West, like, you know, circle the wagons kind of, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that, I get what you mean.
Because after that, Japan really went very hardcore, we're not going to let the West in, like, period. Like, the government really pushed hard to make it where Western companies were not going to be able to sell their products in Japan because they wanted to control that market. And it's very typical of Japan's government to sort of that sort of crony capitalist thing where it's like, we love capitalism as long as it's Japan making the money. And we're going to prop up businesses that help us. So there was a lot of that, which, you know, I'm not knocking it. That's what they do to make sure that they come out on top.
I mean,
you can't
hate it.
No. But nevertheless, there was a that. And I think that in a way, it both hurt and helped the market because it allowed companies like NEC to have massive dominance for a long time. But then once it broke, Japan was really far behind and had to do a lot of catching up, and they still haven't caught up. I think Japan still today culturally is not as connected to computers as the West is. When you look at like – this is, for example, like for me in my school – very, 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 very few, like maybe like 1% of my students have a computer at home.
Oh, wow.
And it's because in Japanese culture, it's still, there's still this mindset that computers are very expensive and you don't need one until you get to college. So they learn like very, very basic computer skills in high school. Like,
right, like
we're talking like typing and how to look for a website, you know, how to use a web browser.
Boy.
Yeah. I went to one of the computer classes one day. This was like 4 years ago or something, maybe even longer than that, 5 years ago when I first got there. And it was still in the time, this is, you know, this would be like 2000, like late 2014. So it's still in the time where smartphones hadn't completely and totally caught on in America and in Japan. And so.
So it took a little while to catch on over there, didn't it?
So I would have expected kids to know how to, you know, use a web browser. And today, I don't expect it as much because kids can look it up on their phone. But at that time, it was still not completely there yet. And it was weird to me because the teacher's assignment for the whole class was, here's a list of news websites. I want you to look them up and write down the top headlines in each one and just list them into a file. I was like,
wow,
really? Like, that's like high school level computer skills, is look at the top five Japanese news websites. Like, basically, that's like every kid knows how to open up a web browser and type in a website. And
right, anyone has used a smartphone pretty much.
But now, but see, like that's not normal skills here. And so if you even know how to use like PowerPoint, okay? If you can use PowerPoint, you are a star here. Like, if you can turn on and turn off a computer when it's acting up, or if you can fix something, you're like a major star, because they're just not, it's not a part of their culture. And I feel like part of that goes way back to these early days where there was this big push towards computers and it was going great, until there was this sort of like arbitrary external force that said, we're going to push it in this direction and not allow Japan to match the rest of the world's industries. And it affected prices, it affected availability, and it affected the culture. And so the culture of Japan never caught on, and the prices definitely never came down the way they did in the US. And so to bring that back to the 8,000 or the 8,800, how would you say that long? Just say 88.
8,001. Or are you saying 88?
The 88. Yeah, so if you were to say that longly, long ways, it would be like 8,801. Like, you can't really shorten it other than just saying 88.
They usually pronounce it in the commercials as like Pishi Hachihachi Maruichi, right?
A lot of times, even they shorten it to Hachihachi.
Yep.
So yeah, nobody likes that. I don't think anybody likes to say that number properly, which I don't blame them. But anyway, to bring it back to that, they're expensive. They're mega expensive. They're definitely not cheap. I mean, the SR, the Model 30, which has the two floppy drives, that comes in at 25 mon, 8,000 yen. That's 258,000 yen, which translates to around, well, right now's money, it would be like 2400 or so,
give or take.
Back
then it was a lot less in dollars, but you have to keep in mind, I believe the average Japanese salary hadn't quite really hit its current levels until about the late 80s or so.
Yeah, I mean, this is 85, so this is like right near the high point of the bubble.
Bubble economy.
Yeah, so while that was expensive, that was relative expensive. There was a lot of money flowing around in Japan. If you were a businessman, you probably had enough money that you could make that work. But it was still a lot of money.
And it's still a lot of money. The thing that's interesting is I actually have a copy of old PC from, I think, July 1985. If you look at the ads for like all the stores in Akihabara, a lot of them do something really interesting. They'll have the price listed, like the NEC list price, and then it'll be crossed out, and they'll have like a whole bunch of different payment plans. And what's really weird is pretty much all of them, if you add up the total of payments, it's smaller than the list price. And I almost wonder if that's also some sort of weird way of getting around, like, rules on advertising prices below list. You know, like how websites do the whole add to cart to see low price thing. It's like,
well,
that.
Yes and no. In Japan, what I've noticed is that, especially with technology, the manufacturer's retail price suggested retail price is literally a suggestion. You are apparently quite free to raise or lower that price if you wish. So, like, for example, when I go out and buy a new Switch game, I actually am careful about which store I buy it at, because some stores will mark up the price a couple hundred yen and some stores will mark it down a couple hundred yen. It is not a set strict thing the way it is in the US.
Yeah, I was going to say, here in the US, the prices are like all fixed for the most part, unless it's been out a long time. It's in the clearance bin.
Yeah, no, here there are some, like, for example, there's a store called near my house called Nojiba, which is just an electronics store, kind of like a Best Buy or something like that.
Okay. Or like a Yamada Denki.
Yes. But their prices are usually a few hundred yen higher than if you went to like a Geo or one of the places that's like a mainly like a game and tech and entertainment stores. Sometimes they will be, or even Book Off carries new stuff. So, or, well, some of them do. Well, no, actually, I take that back. Some of the Book Offs are joined with a company called Mediapolis. Media, like Mediapolis, but Mediapolis.
Fancy sounding.
Yeah, it's hard to pronounce outright. But anyway, Mediapolis and Book Off, like, have some of them are like joint, so the store will be like half and half. And when you go into the store, there's like one register that's like the Mediapolis register, and one register is like the Book Off register. And if you sell stuff back, you have to like sort it between like books and CDs and movies go to the Book Off counter, and video games go to the Mediapolis counter. It's really weird. But anyway, those are usually a little bit cheaper than like your Yamada Denki. And if you go to like a one of those like kind of like a mall kind of thing, like they don't really have them, like a department store. If you went to a department store kind of situation to buy it, it's probably going to be a little bit more expensive than even that. So it's really weird. But yeah, so I think it's not entirely all that surprising to see stores in Akihabara marking down prices. But yeah, either way, we're talking like $2,400 in 1985 Japan money, which is still, well, you know, you probably might have been able to have that if you were a salary person. It was not cheap. And there's plenty of stories if you go back and read, like the book, The Untold History of Japanese Game Developers. There are stories in there about people who are like, yeah, I bought a computer and it took me like 2-3 months of saving to do it. Or I got my company to buy it for me or stuff like that. So they weren't cheap. But the thing is that while they came down some, computer prices didn't drop the way they did in the U.S., for a very, 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 very long time. It wasn't really until like the mid to late 90s when they opened up the market and a sort of slow trickle/flood came in that the prices started going down to more comparable levels. So these are very expensive machines, but they're really good machines for the time. The SR, like we mentioned, adds the Yamaha 2203 sound chip, the OPN, and also adds in the graphics mode. This is called the V2 mode, and V2 mode is what you need to play pretty much any game, or any game that's not one of those basic games, which is the majority of games. And man, these games are awesome. I don't know about anyone else. Some people are just kind of like, eh, whatever, or the graphics aren't great, or whatever. I think they're fantastic.
I agree.
I think PC-88 is probably the most fun system to play on. 98 is cool, and the earlier games on 98 are cool, and they look slightly better because the graphics capabilities of the 98 are better, but they don't have quite the same level of attractiveness, appeal to me, as the 88 does. 88 is just a product of its era.
It really is.
I think that's a wonderful thing about it. What game would you say is your favorite that you've played on 88?
I think my favorite on the 88 is probably, weirdly enough, Star Cruiser. Have you ever played that?
Oh, I have that game, yeah. I haven't played it very much, but I do have
it. It's hard.
Yeah. I could tell.
It's hard, but I like it because, you know, my background is in software development. So when I see a game like that, I kind of just go, wow. They had to put a lot of effort into that. You know, it's literally it's literally a 3D polygon first person shooter almost running on a Z80. I mean, that's some skill. And this is what, 1987, 1988, I think. It just amazes me to see it.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff on the 88 where you can tell that people really put a lot of time and effort into it. And this is one of the reasons why I prefer it over the MSX system. And now I'm probably going to get a lot of hate down the line for this, but I feel like the MSX is a system where, unless people were designing specifically for it, there was not a lot of care put into putting games on the MSX. There's a lot of dumping on
the MSX, honestly. A lot of the ports from PC 88 do seem to be rather, shall we say, haphazard.
Yes. And I feel like the MSX as a machine and as hardware is quite good. There's a lot of stuff that you can do with it. And if you've got that in mind and you're really good at using that hardware, you can make some great stuff. And I think the fact that it has sort of a worldwide appeal makes it very, very attractive to homebrew development, whereas PC88 is not at all attractive to homebrew development. But
which is a shame.
It is. I really wish there was more tools and information out there and more hardware out there.
Well, I've been trying to solve that on the PC98 front. I just haven't quite branched out to the PC88 side of things. PC98, I actually have a few programming books on, and I've undertaken some efforts to make PDF copies of some of them. And there's some information out there now, but of course, it's kind of all in Japanese, so that doesn't help a lot of people here in the West now, does it?
Sure.
So one of my long-term plans is to kind of put together a good repository on a PC88 and PC98 programming information, you know, tips, tricks, source code, just try to get the stuff all somewhere, you know what I mean? Because I think kind of get that info out there, they'll probably encourage existing homebrew types, you know, maybe already familiar with Z80 machines, to kind of dig into the world of the PC88, you know?
Yeah, and I think one of the advantages that 88 has in that way is the emulation for it is pretty good.
Even on a PC98, you can emulate a PC88 pretty well.
Yeah. That's another thing. Like, even if you have a PC98, as long as you've got like a fairly decent model, like I guess you can do it on any of the 21s, really, right?
Yeah, I think it's been a while since I looked at the documentation, but I think it said as long as you didn't need YM2608 ADPCM emulation, you could do fine with like a 486, I think.
Really?
So yeah, 9821 would sound right. I think it said you needed like a Pentium at some speed for that to work right, but it worked fine with me on Snatcher on a Pentium 120, I think.
Yeah, I used a Pentium as well, and I thought it ran really, really well. But so there's a lot of different ways to emulate the PC88. You can do it on PC. There's lots of different random emulators. There used to be one for Wii, actually.
Why am I somehow not surprised?
Right. There's, of course, like you said, there's 98 has great emulation for the 88. But I feel like there should be more hard development than there is for it, because once people really learn how to use it, I think in general, the emulation would support the average user who's going to not mess with the hardware and still want to play those games. Whereas if you do want to actually release your games on, you know, actual disc for the hardware, it's actually a lot easier to release that than it would be for MSX or something, because with MSX, you need to make a cartridge. With this, you know, all you got to do is get a stock of 5 1/4 floppy disks and write them.
Well, MSX also had discs too. You could use
usually
3.5 inch. But yeah, most MSX games came on cartridge.
Right. Well, most homebrew people don't release their games on floppy disks because they feel that it's actually, well, for one thing, a lot of the hardware developers are writing for MSX 1, which didn't so much have floppy compatibility.
Right.
But also, not completely, but mostly didn't have floppy compatibility. But also, there's a sort of a feeling within the MSX world that floppy disk is not as good because not all the computers had it. And so there's this feeling that with the cartridge, you're guaranteed the full range of compatibility with machines because they all have cartridge slots. Whereas when you do it with floppy, you're cutting your user base in half at at best.
Yeah, and then so, there's also the issues with, like, floppies going bad. You know, there haven't really been any new stock media for a while. You get the idea.
But with 5 1/4 inch floppies, I mean, yeah, theoretically, you know, you're going to get some that go bad or whatever, but they're actually a lot, they're a lot more resilient than people give them credit for.
Oh, absolutely. I concur with that.
I've found that 5 1/4 inch holds up better than 3.5, and it may just because there was a lot more cheaper 3.5s made in the late 90s, but nevertheless, 5 1/4 inch seems to last longer and is easier to clean.
It really is.
So the 8801, we get the Mark II SR, which adds our graphics mode called V2, which gives you 640 by 200 with 8 out of 512 colors, so it can vary those colors around.
Yep, that's the big difference in the V2 mode. And that's what really makes a lot of the games look a lot better, because you can do dithering with much more customized palettes.
And if you have 640 by 400, you have 2 out of 512 colors instead of, you know, black and white, basically. So there's a lot more that you can do with it. Now, later on, there's a V3 mode, which I don't know how many games even use that, honestly.
I think it's something around a dozen. I actually kind of dug into the PC-88 VA at one point, which is the machine VA, VA2, VA3. Those are the V3 mode machines. They're actually really kind of curious, because they're not quite really PC-88s. I think the kind of closest analogy you can make is it's kind of like the Apple IIgs versus the Apple IIe, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's got a 16-bit processor. It's actually a weird V30 variant that can also switch into a Z80 mode. Really interesting stuff. And so it's actually a 16-bit machine that runs, believe it or not, a version of DOS that, strangely enough, is named PC Engine.
Are we talking about the Apple or the PC-88?
Oh, I was using the analogy that, like, PC-88 VA is to PC-88 as Apple IIgs is to Apple IIe. Because they went from an 8-bit to a 16-bit processor and retained compatibility, more or less.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I see.
And weirdly enough, the VAs... The VAs actually have PC-98 CBUS slots, weirdly enough, even though they're incompatible with PC-98 software, yet they run DOS. Very confusing, and no wonder it didn't go anywhere, huh?
Yeah, I've never used any of the VA machines. So, NEC had this cute little naming system where they were like, okay, SR, then they were like, okay, TR. Well, what's the TR? Well, the TR is like the SR, but with a modem. Okay, well, then there's the FR. Well, what's the FR? Okay, well, the FR is cost reduction. Okay, well, what did they change? Well, apparently they lowered the... Now, what did they change on it, actually?
Got rid of
N-mode. They took out N-mode, yeah. And then they come out with this thing, okay, we've got the MR. Okay, well, what's the MR? Well, it's got more RAM. Okay. But... It also has a 2HD floppy drive instead of 2D. And this is actually really important now, because it's actually a lot easier to get your hands on 2HD floppy drive disks than it is to get 2D. And if you format them in the PC-88 machine and then use this special program, which I can't remember, it's like an X-Trans disk something or other, I don't remember. You can you can actually write game images back to blank floppy disks. And if you have one of the machines that has the 2HD disks, you can write a 2D disk, which is, you know, like 320 kilobytes or something, onto a 2HD disk, which is basically twice that. And it will still read it properly, which means you can use 2HD disks, which are much easier to get. If you have one of those models, the actual software almost never used 2HD disks, because even though they, like, some of the models had the drives, most of the software companies just said, well, we want it to be as compatible with as much as we can, so we're going to use the 2D disks. But it's really handy if you have one of the M series, because you get the 2HD drives, and that makes it easier when you're trying to old school pirate these games. But yeah, along the way, I believe with the FR, they also cut out the tape adapter thing port.
It says MR here. I got the Japanese Wikipedia article up in front of me. It says the MR was the one where they got rid of it.
Okay, the FR may have still had it then.
Yeah, it seems so.
Because I can't remember. I know that the SR did have it.
Oh, wait, actually, maybe it didn't, because they are shown as being released in the same month. I didn't notice that. So maybe it also had it abolished. Who knows?
I think the SR had it, was the last one to have it. Because I had an FR, and I'm pretty sure it did not have it on there. But I can't remember off the top of my head.
I'll take your word on that.
But anyway, so not long after the SR, we'll say, they get rid of the compatibility with the tapes. And that's fine, really, because there's not very many tape games on it that you'd want to play anyway. The majority of what you're going to play is on 5 1/4 inch floppy. Okay, so going down the line, we get the MR, which is 2 HD. And pretty much the way it works is anything M means you're going to have the 2 HD discs. Anything F means it's cheaper version than what's M. And then anything with V means it's got that different processor that we were talking about. So then you get the FH and the MH, and these include a faster processor that's now 8 megahertz instead of 4 megahertz, and it has a switch, so you can switch it back into 4 megahertz mode if you want to, which is helpful for some games, but actually most of the games run fine and even in 8 megahertz. From my experience, I've only got a little bit of experience with it so far because I just recently got one of those machines. So then you get the VA, FA, and MA, and these are basically the same thing as your FH and your MH, except for the fact that they've got a sound upgrade. So now instead of the YM2203, which is mono, you have the YM2608, which is stereo and has 80 PCM. Ooh, ah. Mm. And I have not played too many games that use this, but the one game that I have played is called The Scheme. And this is a game that's famous for music by Yuzo Koshiro. And the music is great. And with that sound upgrade, it sounds fantastic. And I actually made a short video of it. It was my very first Instagram post on my Doors and Dungeons Instagram. Please check that out if you haven't already.
I need to.
Plug. Well, that was for the users, but you can too. Users, podcast users, listeners.
Anyway. Listeners, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was for them, but you can feel free to follow my Instagram as well. Anyway, that's that, like that short little video of The Scheme music is the very first thing I posted, and it's still the most popular post on my Instagram.
Amazing.
Yeah, so they introduced this new sound upgrade, and almost all of the models after that have it. Your FA, your VMA. There was like an FE that didn't have it, but it did have TV out, which is weird.
I guess I might have been like, well, looking at the price, I guess it was kind of like a low-end.
Yeah, the model. F series were all lower end than the M's, and it was usually the RAM that was the big difference, and also the 2 HD floppy drives.
Right.
And then the V series, like the VA2, those have those V50 chips, which are slightly different, as you were mentioning before. So to me, the perfect model to have is either an MR, an SR, depending on what you want to do. It's either like an MR, an SR, or an MA. And the reason, there's reasons for each, and I'll ask you what your favorite is after this, but I'll say the SR is probably the most compatible across the board because it's the slower processor and the original sound chip, but it's got compatibility for the older games, for the in mode stuff and the anything like the Mark II or the 8801, sorry, can play. And it's got the tape port. So that's cool about the SR. The MR is probably the second best, if not really in some ways the best that you can get, because while it doesn't have that tape port, it does have the 2HD, which means that it's going to be a lot easier to write your own discs instead of buying all the games every time you want to try out something, which can be really hard and expensive to do.
To say the least.
Yeah. And it also is still fairly compatible with most of the software in the system's range. And it's usually one of the cheaper models to get because it uses the original keyboard, and that's important. And then the third recommended model is the MA, which is what I have now. And the MA adds the 8 megahertz mode and the upgraded sound. And it also has 2HD, which is really nice for your floppy disks, and it's got more RAM. The big drawback to it is that it uses the later keyboards, because they did sort of, after they did this 8 megahertz thing around the FH series and MA series, they changed the design of the front panel a bit, and they also changed the keyboard. They added in a few keys, and they actually changed the whole port for the keyboard as well, and those keyboards are like twice the cost. And sometimes they're literally 2 to 3 times more than the actual computer itself. And it's really, really frustrating.
Yeah, actually, a friend of mine who's getting into PC-88 stuff was actually telling me the same thing about the keyboards, that they just changed it all the time. It's a pain to find the right one.
Well, yeah, but see, the thing is that they didn't start changing it until around 86. So from all throughout, like, the SR up to the H's, they were all the same keyboard.
Right.
So, like, your SR, your TR, your MR, all those use the same keyboard. And it wasn't until the H and the A's that they started changing those keyboards. Which, I technically, that's more than half of the series, but still. They only used one keyboard before that. And then after that, they were like, okay, we're going to have Type A, and then Type B, and Type C, and Type G or something. Like, they just started going. There's, like, 5 different types, and each computer can use like 1 to 3 of those types, and you don't really know, you can like find a guide to which one. But typically, most people are trying to get the Type A, which seems to be like the most compatible. It's what I have. And it works on this MA. And I spent about 3 months trying to get one of those keyboards, just like looking for it on auctions. And you'd try and get it, and you'd start out low, and then in the last like 10 minutes, it would jump up to like $150. Basically.
I seriously don't know how people manage to win these auctions.
I tried for 3 months, and I ended up having this, in all, I ended up spending like $150. And I literally did it by just saying, okay, I've slightly got enough money right now. I'm just going to just go all in and say, I'm willing to pay $160 and put that in as my max bid and hope that I got it. And I finally did. And it literally, there's no really good way to undercut the market. You're going to be stuck paying it, period.
Unfortunately.
It's really unfortunate, yeah. There's an adapter, which defeats the point in a way to me, because the adapter allows you to use, you can buy either one for PS2 keyboards or USB. And to me, it's like, okay, well, this is cool because, you know, yes, some of the buttons are different, and there's some keys that aren't on there that you have to like,
yeah, it's alternate. Always kind of awkward, and you can easily make an argument that that's kind of, I mean, this is more of a subjective thing, but a lot of people do feel it's not quite the same experience.
It's not. And I would be fine with that. I mean, it would not be ideal, but I would be fine with that, except for the fact that those adapters are 8,000 to 9,000 yen themselves.
Yikes.
Which is, and they do not change in price. They're always like, it's like 7,500 something yen for the PS2 version and like 9,000 for the USB version. And that's, I mean, that's still twice the cost of the computer.
Yeah, no kidding.
For one adapter. And to me, it's like, if I'm going to spend almost $100 for an adapter or $150 for the real thing, I'm going to just spend the extra for the real thing, even if it takes longer and it's harder to do. Because this is just a waste of time otherwise.
Agreed.
Like, if the adapter was $20, okay, great, sure. If it was $30, okay, yeah, that's way better than $150. But like $90 for an adapter to make a keyboard work on a computer, it's not even like the right keyboard.
Yeah, I have to concur that's overpriced.
It is. Especially since it's not very much to the actual technology. Like, it's just like,
I'm sure it's no more than like an Arduino, I'm sure.
I think it's even slightly less than that. It's like one IC chip that's been programmed to just like swap the keys for the ones that are different, and then like two ports.
Yep, sounds about right.
It's just, it's really ridiculous that it costs that much, but whatever. So, if you can get into the hardware, great. If you don't get into the hardware, play it in emulators. It won't look right. I will argue that even though emulators are really good quality, unless you get a CRT screen that's like a really low-end CRT with like a really low resolution, the way the PC-88 does dithering effects for the colors does not look right on an LCD screen. It just doesn't.
I agree.
And this was actually a fun fact with my friend Tom Lipschultz, who is often on this podcast. When I brought him here and actually showed him the PC-88 for the first time, he always kept telling me, I played PC-88 games, I don't like how they look. And I was like, well, really? Because they look fine to me. And he's like, yeah, I don't know. I played them, like I played through Ease 1 and 2 on the Project Egg and that kind of stuff. And I just didn't like the way they looked. The dithering looks really bad. And I was like, well, you know, if you're playing them on an LCD screen, maybe that's your problem. And it's like, maybe, but I just don't think the dithering, the way they do it, is good. Okay. I got him here. I turned on an original NEC monitor. This is one of those KD whatever things. It looks really chunky and cute, I think. and loaded up the game. He also said that he doesn't like the way like it has the widescreen kind of look, because it is a weird resolution. It's, most of the games are 640 by 200,
right,
which is kind of squashed. It's kind of almost like a widescreen, but it doesn't actually fill up the entire space on the CRT screen.
Right, is, because square, you know, pixels, yeah.
Right. But he's like, I don't really like that either. And I'm like, okay. I show him on the real hardware, and he's like, wow, this looks a lot better than I expected. I actually kind of like this. I was like, yeah, I told you. It's really different playing it on a real machine than it is playing it, you know, on an emulator. So if you do play with these games, if you do play it, like pull it up on an emulator, just know that it's not going to look the same. And if at all possible, and this sounds really dumb and cheesy, but if at all possible, go down to a whatever recycle store or Goodwill or whatever you can find, get an old CRT monitor, the lower the resolution better, and just like put it in like 640 by 400 or 480 or whatever it is resolution, and load up the emulator, and it'll look better. Not gonna look perfect, but it'll look better. That's all for part one of our discussion on the PC-88 system. In the next episode, we'll be diving into what you really care about, the games! There's so many great PC-88 games to discuss, too. Well, it is time once again for our old favorite, Shameless Self-Promotion Corner! As you may know, I hate doing self-promotion, but I have to do it if I want to keep this stuff alive, so let's see if I can make it as awkward as possible instead. Okay, let's see. So, like, big news-o-rama, I have recently rebranded both my YouTube and Twitch channels into official Doors and Dungeons channels. With this, I'm going to start pushing myself to you know, do more stuff. I'm setting up a VHS camera and designing an opening for a new series of retro-inspired gaming reviews filmed entirely on VHS. I'm also going to be doing more streaming of things like Switch games and stuff. And like the other day, I live streamed myself doing game translation. So maybe more of that because it was surprisingly popular. That all leads me to the mega disaster that is money! Yes, money. The one thing I both need and really, really hate asking for. It's like I'm an NPR show. Patreon. It's a thing. It makes money for a select few people. My ultimate goal is to one day get to $200 a month, and that would allow me to do way more work with this Doris and Dungeons brand, as well as pay for servers and a better website, and hopefully a better mic, actually. So if all that sounds lovely, and you really like what I'm doing here, please, please go to patreon.com/doorsanddungeons and contribute in any way, small or large. I added a new $1 tier because Patreon is weird. Also, I have almost entirely stopped using my personal Facebook and Twitter accounts and am instead focusing on the Doors and Dungeons accounts exclusively. That means you can talk to me about games more easily. Woo! So on Twitter, it's @DoorDunPodcast. That's @DoorDunPodcast. And on Facebook, there's the Doors and Dungeons page, which you can search for. There's also a Discord server that people are joining, and I'll put a link to that in the description. Anyone who becomes a Patreon member gets a cool green color for their name on Discord, showing their epic Patreon status. Ooh. Other Discord members will be green with envy. Or rather, not green with envy. Or something. And like and subscribe on YouTube. Rate us on iTunes or Spotify, and do whatever you can to say, yay, thanks, because it means a lot to me, truly. This has been Doors and Dungeons.